And it is 9 p.m. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York. Time now for Backstage Stories.
Good evening. Welcome to Backstage Stories on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host, and tonight we complete the celebration of Women's History Month. We are truly excited to have this woman with us this evening. She is an actor, a singer, author, playwright, screenwriter, director, producer, filmmaker, activist. She has won just about every theater award available, including a Tony, a Obie, a Drama Desk, Outer Critics, Circle, Garland, LA Drama Critics, Lucia Lortel. She's won three of those. Adelco, Monarch, NAACP Theater, Stage Raw, Alfred Drake and Clarence Derwent Awards, and a whole bunch of nominations, other theater nominations. You've seen her on Broadway at least 9 times, off-Broadway, in daytime dramas, nighttime series. She has 2 series coming up, and we'll ask her about them later. And she has her own podcast. And finally, because her work has been so impactful, in 2020, she won the Rachel Crothers Leadership Award from the League of Professional Theater Women and the Frankie Award for Extraordinary Impact on Contemporary Theater and Performance. And with all of that, I will say welcome, Tanya Pinkins. Hello.
Hey, Marcia. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for being here. And we're just going to get started with some of your background, because I'm quite sure that a lot of our listeners are familiar with your work in theater, television, and film. But don't know much about you. So let's just start from the beginning. Where are you from? Where did you grow up?
I'm from the south side of Chicago. Actually, I was born on the west side and then grew up on the south side, Jeffrey Manor, and went to Whitney Young High School in downtown Chicago. One of the underclassmen was a woman named Michelle Robinson, who grew up to be Michelle Obama.
Okay.
And then I went to Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, and then got my first Broadway show my freshman year in college over my Christmas break. I was went to a cattle call and was cast in Merrily We Roll Along, and knew that I would be coming to Broadway the next year.
What part did the arts play in your life growing up? What sparked your interest, and how did you know that this was definitely what you wanted to do?
That's such a funny question. I don't know that I knew that this was definitely what I wanted to do, but my mother certainly had me in etiquette and elocution classes from the time I was about 3 years old. And I remember I was in some little music theater program downtown Chicago. Frances Moore, I think her name was. And I did, when I was about 8 or 9, I did Peter Pan, and I did Sound of Music. And so I guess, you know, me and my friends, we would make up our little songs, and I would do a lot of painting. And I was very shy, amazingly. I remember when I got cast in The Miracle Worker in 7th grade, I wouldn't sing the song. I hummed it. I wouldn't sing the Mockingbird song. I was too nervous to sing in front of anybody by then.
Oh, wow. I can't imagine you not being able to sing in front of people, because you're such an amazing singer. You arrived in New York before you finished school,
yeah.
What was that like? What was that like coming to New York at 18, 19 years old? You know, really green, I guess.
Yeah. You know, I visited New York when I auditioned for Juilliard, and I would come to New York to see shows, and I really didn't want to live in New York. It seemed like a very, very hard and cold city. It made me very, very sad to see all the homeless people and people just walking by them. And my first apartment was on 47th, right down the street from the TKTS booth. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we were rehearsing down at what was then the Michael Bennett Studios, I remember one day riding the bus. I forget, something had gone wrong. The subways had stopped working. And like a bus sort of almost touched a biker, and the biker got off and slammed, you know, his fist into the bus. And while he was doing that, someone stole his bike. And I was like, oh, this is not the city for me. But as fate would have it, I was supposed to be here, and I've spent more than half my life in New York, and it's the place where done my most of my work, so it's my destiny.
You have worked with some amazing people in this town. Can you tell us a little bit about who some of those people were and how they enabled you to grow professionally?
Gosh, I've worked with some of the greatest artists of my generation. I've worked personally with Stella Adler. I studied with Stella Adler and Warren Robertson and Larry Moss and William Esper. I did a play with Arthur Miller, Arthur Lawrence, Steve Sondheim, Larry Moss, Eve Ensler. I've worked with Lloyd Richardson. I've worked with August Wilson. I've worked with Kenny Leon. I've worked with Sheldon Epps, David S. Bjornson. So many people. I think the person who has had the greatest impact on my career is definitely George C. Wolfe.
And how did he have that impact on your career?
First of all, he's just... I think anybody who's worked with him will tell you that it ruins you for life. He's so smart. He's so funny. He's so, has such a deep humanity. You just rarely run into people who have all that. And I think seeing myself reflected in his eyes and the opportunities that he gave me are what have allowed me to really blossom into being a multi-hyphenate artist in the way he is.
What makes you say yes? Oh, before I ask you this question, you worked with him in Jelly's Last Jam, and that's what gave you your Tony Award, correct?
Yes.
And what was it, I have to ask this fangirl question. What was it like to work with the late, great, I think, great Gregory Hines?
You know, Gregory was a dream to play with on stage. People may not know that most of his solos on stage were improvised. Both he and Savion, they just are improvising that brilliant dance the way a jazz musician improvises. And to act with him was that same way. It was, you know, the lines are the same, the blocking is the same, but it was a live and a new performance every night. And it was awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, to get back to the question that I wanted to ask you before that broke in, what makes you say yes to a project, and what makes you say, no, I'm not doing that?
I think that's changed as I've gotten older. Early in my career, I had people that I wanted to work with because I had seen their work and admired it. And the first people I most wanted to work with because of listening to the songs from the shows they made were Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim. And so my first Broadway show was with Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim. And crazily, it was their first big flop. And they didn't see each other again for decades. So I always have a list of people whose work I admire and that I want to work with. And it's something I always tell my students to do, because I think there's something about planting the seed of your desire in your consciousness so that you're suddenly sending out rays to the universe to bring that energy into your life. Generally, projects, if the people are people whose work I know, I'm going to come in the room because I just want to play with those people. And sometimes if it's people whose work I don't know, it's if the script speaks to me. But mostly, you know, because I go to so much theater, when there was live theater, I was probably at the theater 4 or 5 shows a week. So I'm aware of who's doing what, because I'm just curious and interested and always want to work with the people who are doing something new and cutting edge. So really, it's just like, oh, I want to go play with them.
Can you share who's on your list right now, who you want to go play with?
I'd like to play with Sam Mendes, Yvonne Van Hove, who else? Denzel Washington, Nate Parker. Those are the people at the top of my list.
Okay. And what is it that you would say no to?
I think right now I'm saying no to things that I don't have some sort of ownership of. Like, I've been doing this business for almost 50 years. And I've spent most of that time, you know, building other people's castles. And in getting to make Red Pill, the movie, this year, and also producing the Truth and Reconciliation plays, I was like, oh, I like this producing thing. I like being a boss. So I think for however much time I have left, I want to be part of the creative team. I want to not just be a tool for somebody else's artistry.
Okay. This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host. And Max, let's hear Fellowship by Michelle Indigliacello.
This path without the promise of heaven, paradise, streets paved in gold. Would you stay your sister, your brother, name for another man's greed? Cause if you believe that your God is better than another man, all your suffering, if you believe that your God is better than another woman, how you gonna end all your suffering and strife? You believe great God gonna come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know life is a word, you'll look for yours here on earth. It's at hand. Cause if you believe that your God is better than another man, how you gonna win all your suffering? If you believe that your God,
That was Fellowship by Michele Indigliacello. And that is the song that brings you into the film Red Pill. Written, directed, produced by and starring Tanya Pinkins. I saw the film, y'all. It is amazing. It is full of twists and turns. And before we went on the air, I said to Tanya, you know, I wasn't expecting that. I was absolutely not expecting that. But that is the song that brings you into this film called The Red, not The Red, but it's called Red Pill. Why did you decide to become a filmmaker taking on this project? How did it come to you?
I think a big inspiration of mine was definitely Ava DuVernay mm-hmm. thing doing. And I feel like as I get older, I get smarter and I get better. Mm-hmm. And the opportunities that were starting to be presented to me just weren't up to my capacity. Like, I was getting offered less and less to do as I was getting better and better at my craft. And so I tried to do things the way you're supposed to do thing, like applying to take classes or go to get another degree or asking people to be their assistants or shadowing with different directors, applying to the different programs and fellowships. And essentially I was rejected from all of them.
Oh.
After shadowing directors for about 4 years and asking people to actually hire me to be one, nobody was. And so I said, well, you know, I'm going to say yes to myself. So I had set a goal that I was going to make a movie in 2019. And that it was 2018 when I set that goal. And I went to an Actors Fund benefit of the band's visit. And there was a raffle that night. And I won the raffle. And it was like 3-room double occupancy for 9 nights in a hotel in Antigua. And it was like, oh my God, this is a sign, because the movie I thought that was going to be my first one to make was a movie called Bequest, about an activist who's, sort of cut down in the process of her work, but has to fight her way back to live her destiny. And I wanted to shoot it on a tropical island, and Antigua had what I needed. And so I thought that was the film I was going to make. But it wasn't getting done. Like, some people came on to co-produce it with me, and they were not doing what, you know, I thought was going to happen with them. And so I knew that I was about to lose out on this Antigua thing. And I was hanging out with a friend at her country house. And I was like, you know, your house is where scary movies happen. And she's like, I don't know if that's a compliment or what. I'm like, I love scary movies. I want to shoot a scary movie at your house.
Is that where it was?
It really was. I shot it at my girlfriend Kim Sykes' house. You know, the actress Kim Sykes and her husband Thomas Adcock. He's a wonderful writer. And I shot it at their house. So when she said yes, then I wrote the script around the house. I wrote it around paintings in the house. I asked her to make a few more paintings for the film. And so that was the seed of the inspiration. And there are even some events that happened in the movie that actually did happen at her house. So that's where it all happened, at Kim and Tom's house.
Tell us what this movie is about. Can you, I don't want you to give anything away, but
Okay. It's about the moment we're living in right now.
Okay.
From the Black female gaze. It is a Black female lens on white America, and specifically on white women in America. You know, one of the things I've found about just being a Black woman and being a successful Black woman mm-hmm. is I'm still invisible in most places that I go. I still get ignored. I can speak up, speak from my experience and authority, and there'll just be a silence and people move on. There's a way in which my opinion, my thoughts are just not respected or listened to. And I was like, wow. You know, people talk to me and they just, they talk at me. They talk at the idea of me. They don't actually try to get to know me or really want to understand what my life is really like. They just want to talk at the idea. Oh, you're an actress and you've done Broadway and you've done this and you've done that. And they're having a relationship with an idea in their head. And so I said, I don't think that my experience as a Black woman is mine alone. I think this is probably a lot of Black women. So let me tell the story of how we see, or how I see, or how I think a lot of Black women see America right now.
I was absolutely tuned into that. I was absolutely tuned into that. Being a seasoned diva, a woman of a certain age, where you walk into a place and people are like, they walk right past you.
Yeah.
Or if you say something, I'm absolutely with you when your opinions, your experience just completely ignored. Mm-hmm. Ignored. It's, why do you hire me? You hire me as an expert and then you don't listen. I find that absolutely wild, absolutely wild. So I definitely got that because they began to ignore you from the very beginning. I said, they're not listening to her at all. At all. Oh, no, it'll be okay. Just ignore it. And literally a sign, you know, just ignore it. So women, Black women, she wrote this for us.
I did. I wrote it for us because, you know, Malcolm X said the Black woman is the most neglected, underprotected, disrespected person in America. I wrote it for Black women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, I saw the film. I absolutely loved it. And I keyed into that right away because you're hit with that right away. Making a film is not the easiest thing in the world to do. What about the funding? How did you go about finding that? That's the producer part.
Women, we can make a dollar out of 15 cents, honey. I decided I was going to do it. Mm-hmm. And I decided I was going to do it with the resources that I had available to me, with what I could personally come up with, because I had a goal of making a film. And so I hired someone to do my budget and my schedule. And I told her what I had and how much time I had, because I wanted to shoot it Halloween weekend, because then we wouldn't have to pay to decorate things for Halloween. They'd always be there. And my first person I hired was like, oh, honey, girl, you do not have enough money and you do not have enough time to shoot this 85-page script. You need more time and you need more money. And I was like, I then went and asked some people for some money and they said no. And then I met this amazing, 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 inspiring man, Junie Smith, who at the point that I've met him, he'd made 28 films in 27 years. Now he's made 31 films. And he was like, you going to invest in yourself? Then there's nothing that can stop you. If you're going to invest in yourself, there is nothing that can stop you. So you decide when you're going to green light your film. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to green light my film and I'm going to make the film I can make with the resources I have.
Okay. Okay, make that investment in yourself and go ahead and greenlight yourself. Mm-hmm. And you actually did make it over one weekend?
No, we made it over 10 days.
Okay. Well, that's still...
On Halloween.
That's still very quick. But it was very smart to do it. And the decorations were already up. That was brilliant. That was a brilliant move.
Right there.
Your cast, I thought, was absolutely amazing. You had some wonderful people in this cast. Please share with us who you got to play with in this film.
Oh, my God. The cast, the most extraordinary. Like, once again, I say, you know, when you visualize what you want, sometimes it can happen. I wrote this for Ruben Blades and Luba Mason. They're a husband and wife. And I wrote it with their voices in mind, with things that I knew about them. You know, I knew that Luba was an Eastern European woman. And so I wrote an Eastern European character. And so I was writing to actors who I loved. You know, I knew that my own community is very multicultural. So I wanted to represent what my world looks like. And it's funny, one of the biggest things white people ask me is, well, I wanted to know the backstory of how they got together, which really means, why doesn't my world look like those people in your car looked? And it's like, because you don't actually reach out to try to have relationships with people outside of people that look like you. That's just what, I don't know how that happens. That's how I roll in the world. I have indigenous Latino friends, and I have Eastern European friends, and I have Adesola Osakalumi, who is Afro-Caribbean. Mm-hmm. We added a little British on there so we could get that angle of thing going. And then Kathy Irby, who is like, you know, giving us the all-American girl next door, white girl. And then I had an old friend from our kids have been friends since they were like 5 years old, Jake O'Flaherty, you know, bringing in the white male patriarch with a little Jewishness in there. So it was like, we got all the cultures in the stew, which means we can have a whole lot of opinions and thoughts about the world, about politics, about how to handle a crisis. And that mess to me was like what was going to make it exciting. This stew of cultures and points of view, you know, and that most horror films have young people. So the conversation is just stupid. Like the whole opening of the movies for horror films, it's like, you don't even care. You can just go away. But you have to pay attention to what these people are talking about because they're grownups. And they have experience and they're talking about the world and it's real and it's telling you what this movie is about.
And your the cast is going to canvass. It is election. It's right before the election, yes. The 2020 election. Yes. Child, this film is so prescient.
Yes.
When did you finish filming it?
I finished filming it November 11th of 2019.
Wow. Okay. Let me tell y'all that this, I could not get over how prescient this film is. Wait till you see it. You will not believe it because Ms. Pinkins was right on target. Right on target. But you're right, they do have adult conversations and they're not running away from anything. They're not running away. You know, like usually in a horror film, you know, like you have these, they're running all over the house and, you know, like outside and into the barn and all of that kind of stuff.
That's what my 24-year-old likes in a horror movie. She wants them being chased. And I'm like, I don't, chasing and screaming, that's not, I'm not interested.
No, so nobody was running in this. And it was used to wonderful effect, really and truly. What experience prepared you for that moment, for creating that film, that opportunity for yourself, making that investment in yourself? What prepared you to do that?
I think a lot of things really did. I have failed my way through my and so, and I've also worked with some of the greats and watched them fail. So I know that some of the most successful people in the world have failed. So failure is not, doesn't scare me. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was asking friends to come on and help me, and some of them were like, but I don't know what I'm doing and I might disappoint you. And I'm like, And what's the worst that can happen? We'll have a story to tell. Like, that's the worst that can happen. We'll have a story about the time we tried to and we failed. It'll be a good story. So I'm very committed to process. And so I was like, no matter what happens, I'm going to have a great ride. And there will be a story to tell about what we have done. And I think in the process of doing it, I learned that it was so much more than I ever imagined, the amount of work, that films are made in post-production, that the actually writing it, shooting it, casting it, that's the easy part. The post-production is critical. The people you have, that is where a movie is made. It's made in post-production. But what I'm proud to say is that I had to step up and learn how to do a whole lot of things, and I found out that I could. Okay. So it was like, oh, I'm a little studio right here. I can do all the jobs.
Speaking of stories, I saw a story that you told. I believe it was on showbizstories.com. We had Marion on the show a couple of months ago, and we talked about showbiz stories. And one of yours was one that I watched. And I also follow you on social media, on Instagram. And I saw a part of that story as it was happening, but I didn't know what was going on. Could you tell us a story about your editor, how you found your editor? And because I was just absolutely fascinated by that. And I think the audience would love to hear that, because that post-production piece that you just spoke about, that's where the editing happens. And people need to know that. So, yeah. And very critical part process.
I did not know about post-production. I really did not. And I hired an editor who I'd worked with before on a short, and he's very, very talented. And I just didn't know, you know, I had to take his word for how long it takes or what to do. And it was like, he said he'd have a rough cut for me in a month. 3 months later, I don't have a rough cut. Fire editor number one. Hire an interim editor. She quits after 2 weeks. Hire another editor. 9 months later, 9 months and three editors later, I don't have even a rough assembly of my film. And they were working in a program called Avid, which I do not know. Had he worked in a, you know, Adobe Premiere, I could have assembled it myself. So in making a decision and allowing my editor to work in a program that I didn't personally know, which probably most directors have, but in the future, they're gonna have to work in something where I can come behind them and look and see. It's just gonna work out better. No more trusting. The deadlines will be much harder. And so 9 months after we finished shooting, I just had to resign myself to the fact that I failed. I thought I was gonna make a feature film. I thought it was gonna be out in March of 2020. The Madam C.J. Walker in Indianapolis had a screening set for us. Warrington Hudlin was gonna screen us in March at the Museum of the Moving Image. Not only did I not have a film ready, but then COVID hit. And I had just resigned myself that I failed. And that is not for me a place of like, you know, failing is not fun, but I kind of just sit and I failed and I lay down and I cry and I feel really miserable about having failed and all the things I did wrong. And then another part of me is like, so what you going to do? What you going to do? And so I was like, well, I had men editors. I'm going to have a female editor this time. And I just started reaching out to women, but I was limited by this program, Avid. People had to work in Avid. And so I started reaching out to people's lists for women of color editors. And of color for me went, you could be, you know, non-American white. And we got down to four interviews, a German, an African-American, a South Korean, and an Armenian-American. And the South Korean woman was recommended to me by someone who'd seen her work at the Venice Biennale. And I looked at her films. And she's not an editor. Like, that's not what her job is. She's a brilliant filmmaker, Minji Kong. And I just, I was obsessed with her and I was just like a fan. So interviewing each of the women was its own thing. The German woman spent 4 hours telling me everything that was wrong with the film and what she didn't get and who she didn't like. And I was like, well, she clearly not the editor of my movie. And then the African-American woman, she was good. She was, you know, she enjoyed the ride and this Black woman's thing. And so we were like, she's a good candidate. And then the South Korean woman, she had a whole perspective about how she wanted to tell the story. But she didn't want to shoot in Avid, cut in Avid. And then the Armenian woman was actually the most insightful in terms of all of the symbolism and storytelling and that metaphors that are in the story. And, you know, against people's advice, I've had a lot of people telling me that I shouldn't do it because we just spent a lot of money having to retranscode our dailies. That's a very expensive process, like many thousands of dollars. We had just retranscoded into Avid, and Minji Kong said that she wanted to work in Final Cut 7, which is what Bong Joon-ho shoots in. And everybody was like, you can't, you just spent all this money. And I'm like, look, this woman is brilliant. I am not going to decide on the editing of my film based on a program. I'm hiring an artist. An editor is a storyteller. I need an artist. I don't need a system. And so once I decided that, which was a scary decision, I looked at, she was in Seoul at the time. I looked at the COVID stats in South Korea and decided I would go there because the only less than 500 people had died. And once I quarantined in South Korea, we were going to be able to sit beside each other and cut the film where I had been editing for 6 months, you know, on Zoom, which was very, very not intuitive and very difficult to tell stories and waiting for an editor to take your notes and then get back to you. And it wasn't happening. So I flew to Korea in the middle of the pandemic and spent 2 months there cutting the film with Minji Kong.
Wow. And folks, I got to see some of that journey in South Korea because she put it on Instagram. It was absolutely fascinating. I'm like, why is Tanya in South Korea? What is she doing in South Korea? And it wasn't until I saw the what you uploaded to showbizstories.com that I finally understood. And then when I saw the film, I said, it was the perfect thing for you to do. It was the absolutely perfect thing for you to do. Talk a little bit more about post-production and what goes into it and what you learned that you really and truly needed to bring a game that you didn't even know that you had.
Post-production is kind of like general contracting a house. There are a lot of trades and you have to know the order of the trades and when things get done so that you don't spend money repeatedly because you did your trades in the wrong order. So theoretically, you want to get your edit first and you want to get your timings down because once the post-production house, and ours was Postworks Technicolor, conforms the film, it's very expensive to redo that. But while the editor is getting the timings down, you also need to get an early cut that's as close as possible to both your VFX person and your sound designer and your composer. Because ideally, you want everybody's work to be finished at the same time so that the film can be put together. And then we have stock footage. And so I was the person who researched the stock footage and negotiated all the contracts to get the stock footage. What does it cost for your VFX? Then I was the person who was having to look at the VFX and judge the quality. I didn't really have anybody else helping me to look and to decide what was good. I knew what I didn't like, what I did like. And then trying to get all those trades to come together. We lost a composer. I ended up getting an amazing composer in Greece, Tassos Iliopoulos. And then I'm talking to a person and trying to describe the kind of music I want to tell my story. And the music is incredible. And, you know, he's sending me these orchestral pieces. I'm like, no, that's not it, not it. So having to get really clear in what I was describing for my composer. My sound designer was Paul Sue, who is like Motherless Brooklyn and Salt. And I had Michael mm-hmm. Berry. And so, you know, Paul was like, trust me, I have made a few films. Let me show you what I'm going to do. And he did it in, you know, surround sound. And pretty much that was just, I mean, if you're going to listen to the film with the headphones on, that surround sound is extraordinary. So Paul came on as a producer, and he sort of made little trees for me of the map of the trades and where things go. We did go back and unconform some things, and I had to pay to re-edit some scenes, and I ended up bringing another editor on at the end to finish the film, because Minji Kong had gone off to make her own film. And I still had things I needed to do. So I brought the Armenian American film editor, Anna Hofhan Hessen, in to finish doing some re-edits at the end.
Okay. That's a lot. That's a whole lot. This is Backstage Stories on listener supported WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host, and we're speaking with multi award winning hyphenate Tanya Pinkins. And we're talking about her first feature, Red Pill. Getting the film out there. What's next for this film? The festival circuit? Distribution, what's next for it?
It's already been winning awards all over the world. We've been in a number of international festivals. We've won awards in Greece and Sweden and Amsterdam, and been nominated for awards all over. We are going to be in the Michaud Film Festival April 26th to May 2nd. We're going to be in the Hamilton Black Film Festival in Hamilton, Ontario. We've been getting a lot of rave reviews. People are getting it. So we just have to, I mean, our sales agent has sent it out to a number of studios and distributors. And you basically only need one yes to get that licensing window to get the film to people. We're also doing some community and educational screenings and conversations. So I just did a screening and conversation at Barnard College with Hannah Werthen's Black Dramaturgy class. We'll probably be doing more, and some of the wonderful thought leaders and academics in the country, Black women, are coming on board to have panels and conversations really focused on an anti-racism curriculum around the movie that I've designed. And also, I want to start focusing on and ask these women and ask our audiences, what scares Black women and what would make us safe? Because we are always taking care of everybody else. And I want to get us to focus some of that energy on ourselves.
How would the audience, if they wanted to continue to take this journey with you, and find out when the film is going to be distributed or how they can see it at another film festival, how would they do that? How do they have access to the
film? There's so many ways. They can, you know, okay. I just joined community because I have the best part of sharing this film has been the conversations I've gotten to have with people about their experience of it, because everybody experiences something different. So people can, you know, reach out to me at 917-724-8998, 917-724-8998. And I will personally let them know when the next screening is or how their group can arrange to screen the film. And also following us on the website, redpillmovie2020.com. Redpillmovie2020.com is the website. You can see all the laurels and awards and the amazing cast. But I am loving hearing from people about their experience of it, because I've just not seen this gaze in a film yet. So it's delicious for me.
Also, you have, the film is on social media as well. Can you give us
our social media? Our Insta is at Red Pill Movie 2020, and our Twitter is at Red Pill Movie 20.
Okay, at Red Pill Movie 20. Okay, I would like to let everybody know that once the show is archived, which is immediately following the broadcast, you'll be able to find this information on the website in the Backstage Stories archive. All right, there is just a couple of more things that I want to share with you as we go and ask you as we go into our final minutes. We mentioned at the top of the show that you are indeed an activist. Tell us what moves you, what gets you going, what do you support?
I support young people building the world that is going to be the future because it's their world to build. My time is past. This past weekend, I was, listening to panels by Chris Myers with his new anti-capitalism for artists organization that he just launched. So I'm also have worked with the African American Policy Forum in the past, but and I've done a lot of work around helping other women and men who need to go to court, helping them figure out how to represent themselves when they can't afford a lawyer or when the lawyer that they have is not serving their interests. I get, my blood gets boiling around injustice. I can get kind of self-righteous about it, and I can never do enough. But I try to do the little bit that I can.
There's this thing called EDI happening, equity, diversity, inclusion. What are some of your thoughts about EDI and the way it is being presented and implemented in let's say theater or possibly television?
Tanya's not on the EDI train. Okay.
Okay.
I'm on the train. We don't need your equity. We don't need your diversity. We don't need your inclusion. We are the majority people on the planet. And if you give us the resources, we will build empires, which we have proven again and again and again, and you all destroy them. So that's inevitable. That's predictable. So when we're making our business plans, we need to go like, oh, well, about this far in, they're going to destroy that. So we need to already have the plan to rebuild over here. So it's ready to go because, history has told us the summer of 1919, Red Summer, where, Elaine, Arkansas alone, they opened the armory for a week and white people could go get a weapon, and they hunted black people for a week and then took the 12 who lived and put them on trial and convicted them and sentenced them to death for a massacre that they did. So we don't need your help. We need you to get out the way. Okay. Cause we built this country. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm not with the EDI. Okay. I'm not with it. Like,
you have made that abundantly clear. No EDI for Tanya. And
yes, give me the reason. Give me the resources and we will do.
Okay. And speaking of resources, what's next for you? Where are you now? You're filming something that I think the audience would want to know about. Where can they see you next on screen?
Probably the next time you can see me on screen, I have an episode of the New Star series. I play the mother of the lead girl in the new series Run the World, which is, I don't want to insult Run the World, but it's like a fabulous version of black women in Harlem who are going to run the world. So I'm one of the girls' mother in that. And I'm also playing Emmett Till's grandmother in an ABC anthology series called Women of the Movement. Finally, somebody's saying we need 6 hours to tell you about just one woman of the civil rights movement. And hopefully every year they're going to come back and tell you about more of the women, because black women were at the head of every movement in this country. So finally, that people are going to be hearing some of those stories in detail that you've never heard, some of the details of the murder of Emmett Till. Just, whew. And we are shooting it where it happened.
Also, tell us who you're starring with. I think folks would like to know about Miss Adrienne Warren. Before it closed down, she was just burning up the stage.
Yes. As Tina Turner, Adrienne Warren is playing Mamie Till, and Ray Fisher, who is out as a cyborg in the Justice League, is playing Jean Mobley, and Glenn Turman, who was just in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, is playing Mose, and Cedric Joe is playing Emmett Till. It's quite an amazing cast. And Marissa Sharar is the writer, showrunner. Gina Prince Blythewood directed the pilot. Tina Mabry directed the next two. Julie Dash directed the next two. Lemons is finishing us out. This is
That's
with Capital Entertainment, and Will Smith and Jay-Z's company Roc Nation are the producers.
That's extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. You're going to have to come back and tell us about that. I want to thank Tanya for being with us tonight. And also many thanks to Crystal Chase for getting me what I needed in order to make this interview happen. And to you, the listeners, for tuning in. You can find the info about Red Pill on the WBAI website in the Backstage Stories archives. Any final thoughts for us, Tanya?
I can't wait for people to see Red Pill. You know, maybe ask your provider, you know, write Netflix or Amazon and tell them you want to see Red Pill, because there's nothing like the audience asking for something to get it done. You consumers, remember, you have a lot of power. Use it for me and help us bring Red Pill to you.
Absolutely. And that's
917-724-8998.
Okay, 917-724-8998. We're going to say good evening. Please tune in next week for Backstage Stories. We're going to go out listening to American Girl by Laura Bell Bundy. And this is the song that finishes out the film over the end titles, and you will understand why you will be listening to this film, to this song, once you see the film. So enjoy it right now. American Girl by Laura Bell Bundy. Have a great evening, everyone.
I wish it could be simple. Wish I could be happy with what I got. I could live the dream for just 2 hours, sailing on a rented yacht. Trust fund wannabe, get these new shoes, overboard with an overdraft fee. I wish I was happy, but I'm not. Was it so hard being an American girl? Was it so hard living in a first problem world? When the prettiest things are now holding me back, and I can't get away from this massive attack. Was it so hard? Too young for the bar, so I went to the bank. Got a loan for college, where all I did was drink. Working so hard to repay Sally Mae. Gonna have to freeze my eggs if I want kids someday. If you build it, they will come. I don't think that works for everyone. Chevrolet promises windblown hair. Now I'm stuck in traffic, going nowhere. Why is it?
Station. Listener-sponsored WBAI in New York is taking a moment to let you know that WBAI is currently in an emergency membership drive, asking you to renew your membership if it has lapsed or join WBAI right now, and also encourage your friends and your colleagues to join WBAI, become a member. You can join WBAI for a contribution of $25 or more. That gives you a full year subscription membership to WBAI. Please call 516-620-3602 and say you want to become a member of WBAI or you want to renew your WBAI membership. We have a short window, that's until April 7th, to increase memberships for a referendum vote this spring, which determines whether the current democratic structure of the Pacifica Foundation will continue. This bylaw referendum is being put forth by many of the same people who took part in shutting down WBAI in October of 2019. Again, WBAI is looking to increase our voting membership from now until April 7th. This will enable you to take part to vote yes or no to an upcoming referendum which relates to the democratic structure of the Pacifica Foundation. 516-620-3602 is the number to call to say yes, you want to become a member of WBAI. Or please go online, go to WBAI.org and look at the center of the website and click on donation. Please do it and help make this emergency membership drive a success. We thank you so much.
Extinction Diaries. An alarming World Wildlife Fund for Nature study revealed that every human on Earth is breathing, drinking, and eating nearly 2,000 plastic particles each week, the equivalent of a credit card. A Plymouth University study says 700 or more marine species are now threatened with extinction from the 165 million tons of plastic in the sea, 25 times heavier than the Great Pyramid. Plastics break down by sunlight, water, and wind into particles that never truly go away. It is literally everywhere. Even small samples of seawater or beach sand from the Arctic to the Antarctic contain plastic. Studies show that there are 9,000 pieces of plastic per square kilometer of water, and ocean plastic will weigh more than all of the fish in the oceans by 2050. Plastic is in the entire food chain, and invisible microplastics to garbage bags and larger are killing ocean life. In 2019 alone, hundreds of whales and dolphins washed up dead by plastic. The situation is critical. Plastic is leading to extinction and must be illegal. The solution from each of us is clear. Clear as water. My name is Mahia Soul, and this is a Small World Radio production.
Hi,